The preparing portion of the committee meetings, Chair Bale.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I hope everybody is ready to shift gears a little bit. Listening to the Finance and Budget Committee, I'm reminded of many of the challenges and complexities of a university, and I'm always grateful for the work that other people do, and Ann's steady hand, Jennifer's oversight. Those nuts and bolts are important, but I would continue to like to think that the main driver of our success, whether it be in recruiting students, retaining them, or whatever, will be not the beautiful campus we have, or the great athletics, or the nice social scene, or anything else, but what we're providing in terms of academics and building brain power. And so, as I look around the room, I'm always happy to see some of the academics here. And our committee meeting will have some interesting things in it, as always. And even though we have only one action item, but I think it does represent some creativity and innovation on the part of our academic people. And with that, I'm going to ask Provost Lee to talk about our first action item.
Dr. Bale, I appreciate the introduction very much. And yes, Ogden College has come forward with a really bold idea to consolidate three departments, engineering, architectural and manufacturing sciences, and computer science, into a single school. A school that will encompass roughly half the majors in all of Ogden College, which is a pretty substantial sized college. But the goal is to create some academic synergy across traditional disciplinary lines and to establish an administrative structure that facilitates those kinds of conversations and collaborations across traditional and, frankly, old-fashioned and outmoded disciplinary lines. Dean Cheryl Stevens has been kind of the prime architect of this critter, so I'd like to ask Cheryl to talk a little bit about it.
Thank you, David. He said like half of what I was going to say. So. It's fine. We're very excited about this. This is such a great opportunity for Ogden College and for the disciplines of engineering, architectural, and manufacturing sciences, and that includes, I'll talk about those in a little bit, and computer science, those departments. The thing is that Ogden College currently has 10 departments, and these three departments have commonalities that lend themselves to creating a school within Ogden College. And those commonalities include functioning through advisory boards that are staffed with community partners, people who are in industry locally. All of those departments have these kinds of groups that help guide them as they move forward and also provide jobs. These three departments have professional accreditation and could be, at this point, they're through different organizations, but they could all be ABET accredited, which is sort of where we would like to go. And all of the students in these three departments, almost all, go directly from having a degree to a job. There's a few percent that go off to graduate school, but mostly these are our workforce developing departments. And with the push that comes from Frankfurt on workforce development, we believe that creating a school within Ogden supports Kentucky's initiatives in workforce development for this region. And we believe that putting this school together with these three groups, these three departments, will support that. The thing that's really cool about this whole idea is that we go from three departments that function separately like silos to a unit where we can shake up those silos and create new synergistic opportunities. So, for example, now we have engineering has civil, electrical, and mechanical engineering, and all of their meetings include just the three of those groups. But when we do this and we remove the disciplinary or the walls associated with the departments, we can shake those up so that, for example, we could have a building systems group that would have civil engineering program, architectural and manufacturing sciences, I'm sorry, architectural and construction management. So those three disciplines that are coming from two different departments now have this disciplinary overlap that will allow them to build new programs and support their students better. Think about, in addition, the manufacturing areas. We have mechanical engineering, technology management, and manufacturing engineering technology. We could develop a program in industrial engineering, for example, using those three disciplines in a different kind of structure that we can't do now because they're in different departments. So there's also a third one. The information systems group would be computer science, electrical engineering, and computer information technology. They could build a program in computer engineering, for example, that would be very difficult to do with the structure that we have now. So it gives us lots of opportunities for new growth, interdisciplinary growth, and supporting the region. And really, ultimately, that's what this is about. It's about growing a system within this university that allows us to support the workforce development and the students that go out and really impact the economic development of the region. So it's also a public relations opportunity, but that's sort of an aside. We think that ultimately it will serve students' needs better, allow us to grow new programs, impact regional growth, and it's an exciting opportunity.
Cheryl, help me understand. I think I heard you say on the accreditation variable, right now our computer science program is not accredited.
They are working toward it.
Does this help all these programs be fully accredited by combining them into one school?
No, because you accredit programs.
Right.
But the director, the proposed director of the school will be Dr. Stacy Wilson. Stacy, stand up. She and Dr. Greg Arbuckle from the Department of Architectural and Manufacturing Sciences and Dr. James Gary, who's from Computer Science, who's not here, have worked with us to put this together. Now, Stacy, I don't know what your official title is, but she is an official approved ABET
program evaluator.
So she can help us be sure that we can get all of these programs accredited by ABET.
Right. You answered my question.
Yep.
That's a huge consequence of this action to do this. The other is, and I've just made a note, in the recruitment of undergraduate and graduate students, this is mm-hmm. a significant dimension, and we talked earlier a little bit about international. This is the huge destination degree set for international students, and some students who may not be able to get into our engineering programs might find a home in some of these other disciplines.
And we will be able to facilitate the transfer of students from one program to the other because it'll be within that school.
But it is the school that will be the magnet that will attract, I think, additional students here by virtue of having the opportunity to be in such a school. So you have other items on your agenda, but these kinds of consolidations really bode well for us in the future. So, well done.
John?
But I thought you said ABET. It's ABET?
ABET.
And would you just describe a little bit so we understand what that is?
Pacey?
Thank you. ABET stands for the Accrediting Board for Engineering and Technology. It's an international organization that accredits all engineering programs, but it also can include technology programs, computer science programs, and different commissions. So the engineering programs at Western have been ABET accredited from the beginning when we had engineering technology. And then we moved into, so that was one commission of ABET, and then when we had engineering programs, we moved into another commission. So computer science programs can be accredited under the computing part of ABET, and then we have manufacturing engineering technology programs that will also can be accredited under another part of ABET.
And that sounds like a wonderful thing, and I'm sure you all have evaluated. Is there any risk of dilution of the fine programs that we already had? I understand by putting things together you get synergies and all of your explanation, but I mean, you all really look, because I mean, again, these programs are top notch, and so by adding one that's not accredited, I guess that's what I would be concerned.
It won't be long until it is accredited.
I see. Okay.
Yeah. But we don't believe that there's any going to be a dilution effect. We believe that this is a step forward, and this will strengthen all of the programs.
That's wonderful. Thank you very much.
I've got a question. Go
ahead. I just want to. I think this is an absolutely tremendous move.
Good.
It's sort of got it all. It works on recruiting and retaining and graduating and collaborating with two-year colleges. It fits the state's agenda, performance-based criteria, the whole. It's got it all. My question is, in looking at the state's different initiatives for incentivizing higher education, I know they're doing more with two-year colleges, but is there anywhere in that incentive package that what you're going to be doing here, and you really are going to be tackling the workforce readiness goals, is there any linkage between what the state is incentivizing and what you're doing that can benefit?
Yeah, actually, within the last 2 months, I have written and submitted two proposals, each for $1 million and $1.2 million. One of them went to the state for funding through the Work Ready Skills Initiative. And as part of that proposal, what we proposed was to partner with the high schools in the region and the community colleges, so as pipelines into our program. So we're going to develop those relationships. We've already had those conversations, and we do have some articulation agreements in place, but our plan is to expand significantly and develop those relationships so that we can capitalize on the pipelines of students who are being produced in the community college and in high school programs like Project Lead the Way, so they can come directly to WKU.
I just
and
think
you'll hear a presentation later on the higher ed performance funding model. 5% of our future funding will be tied to our capacity to enroll students and graduate students in STEM disciplines. Now that includes a lot of disciplines across two different colleges: health and human services, nursing, physical therapy, and so forth. But this is very strategic in positioning us to seize that opportunity to recruit, retain, and graduate students in the STEM disciplines.
I just make one other comment, and this is more for the benefit of my colleagues. And David, you certainly know this. But I think there's another really remarkable thing about this proposal and what it represents. All three units that are inside of this program are departments that have reinvented themselves over time. I mean, most of you know the story of engineering and Stacy, where you came from and where you've come to, and it's a strong program. The AMS program, I guess, was the old industrial tech program, kind of, and it's totally reinvented and well enrolled. And computer science has new units in it, it's taking a new direction. So to have three programs that over time have totally reinvented themselves and gone in directions that are responsive to changing needs is in itself remarkable. You don't see it. It just happened. And I'm really pleased to see the three coming together. If you'd been a decade ago, I guess engineering wanted a school. but I think this is really where it's going, and I compliment you and the faculty. I think it's great.
Can I ask a question? I see in the material that was given to us or to the committee that each of the departments has advisory boards. Is that correct? I
mean, yes.
Who makes up those boards? Who are those boards? Who's on those boards?
They are mostly companies that are in the region that want to partner with us and hire our students.
Okay. That really interests me.
Last night with the engineering the engineering partners group, where they contribute some of money each year, and they put students in internships and co-ops and engage their students and faculty in a broad range of ways, and it's kind of a partnership with engineering employers across our region.
Okay.
So we replicate that elsewhere.
It'd be just one board now, right? I mean.
You know, there's a lot of details we haven't worked out. I don't think that we can dismantle the industrial partnership, for example.
The engineering group is really focused on engineering.
Okay, and then...
We may have a specific programmatic, programmatic groups. We may evolve into something more overarching.
Well, particularly since you may mix your programs in some way, you may mix your advisory boards in the structure you've got now.
And you mentioned earlier in response to one of Barbara's questions about the workforce committee. Are you going back? They're coming up with another.
I submitted. You mean the second round?
Yes, the second round.
I submitted last Friday.
Okay. When is that? Do you know?
When will they determine?
No, I don't. When's that meeting? Do you know?
My guess is it's in March. I mean, sorry, May.
May.
Just a point of information, Dr. Stevens, is that grant, or is that money is a one-time money, or is that a reoccurring? Because the program itself would stand to think that it was it should be reoccurring money, but how is that?
That money is actually one-time money, and it is predominantly for infrastructure. So the only things you were allowed to purchase with that money were land, buildings, equipment and furniture. So we requested $1 million worth of equipment and a couple of small renovations because, you know, when these programs were built 15 years ago and we had the infusion of funds, McConnell Lab, and that's the last time we've had any significant infusion of infrastructure funds into those programs. So in an effort to upgrade, update, expand, because the numbers have really expanded, the number of students, we need to put some money into the infrastructure so that we can deal with all of these opportunities. So it was an opportunity to apply for $1 million.
And the second tier that Gil is talking about, is that a different type of, no, same kind of infrastructure type?
Yeah.
Of course, it'd be nice if there was
recurring dollars.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. But that's the only way you could budget the programmatic part of this is to be able to. It doesn't sound like the state's putting enough stuff in it.
The challenging part for us, and actually an interesting part, is that in order to get access to that money, you have to partner with private companies.
I see.
But because we have the relationships with the private companies, we were able to figure out how to do that partnership.
So we weren't successful at the first go-around?
No, we were not.
Do you know where you
fell?
We were
close.
How close? Do you know?
The first round, I believe I'm correct.
We missed by about
4-year institutions.
No, for that's right.
Okay.
There were
Who got the money?
Community college.
And
TCS institutions.
Yeah, that's right.
So the thing is, the governor seems to want job training rather than workforce development. And we have to be careful that as a university that we consider ourselves workforce developers, not job trainers. Mm-hmm. And all of the money that they gave that first round was for job training, short-term, low-end jobs. But we're producing leaders. We're producing the people who are going to run the companies.
Who hire low-end jobs.
Who hire those. That's right.
Yeah.
So...
Sound like politics.
But we want the pipeline from the community colleges. We don't want to do the job of the community colleges.
Very nice presentation.
Thank you.
Philip, yeah, I just have one comment. I sit on two advisory boards for other academic areas, and the problem that is a recurring theme in those meetings sometimes is the silos that we have around the university, and there are some silos. I'm very supportive of this. You're tearing down those silos. You're making it work much more efficiently in the way it should be in the best interest of the students and the programs. And you've got excellent leadership for this. And so, but I just really want to commend you for this. I think it's a really great idea.
Thank you. Any other comments?
I'll move.
Second.
Second from Jay Todd for approval to consolidate the Department of Engineering, Architectural, and Manufacturing Sciences and Computer Science into the School of Engineering and Applied Sciences. Any other discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Action item passes, and that brings us to some informational items and follow up the earlier discussion.
Yes, we are withdrawing that for now, and we'll have some further discussions around this proposal, but we're not bringing it to the committee today.
Thank you, Dr. Bell. Good morning. I'd also like to, before we begin, note that I've invited a good bit of the everyone other than the registrar's office, possibly from the enrollment management leadership team. I think that's good for you all to see them and they to interact with the board as well. So we have Chris Jensen in the AARC and Dr. Jace Lux over Director of Admissions, Cindy Burnett over Financial Aid and Scholarships, and Stephanie Seagreen, who is our Director, Executive Director over International Enrollment Management. So that's the EM team that kind of pulls all this ever-changing dynamic of enrollment together. So you have, I believe, floating around the enrollment reporter. Julia is sending that around now. The census date is always 24, 48 hours of our board meeting, it seems, or a committee meeting. The census was yesterday at the close of business, but the report you have is preliminary, but IR will make very minor edits, and then they send that on to CPE. I'll give that a second to float around to you. A good many of the comments we addressed for the enrollment report, Ann kind of hit on those very nicely, or at least set the stage for that earlier this morning. But enrollment management, as you've picked up on and you already know as a board, you've heard this, it's an ever-changing dynamic. It's a very organic division, and that's just the nature of the business of EEM, and particularly in the last year, 18 months or so, continues to evolve and change accordingly. But EEM continues to improve and adapt and overcome to the challenges and opportunities that are presented to us with not only state, nationally, and internationally as that affects our enrollment profile. You will see on the enrollment preliminary report coming around that total all in, all categories, all areas, status, classification, what have you, we're flat this spring at about 18,581. That's, again, all in together. Significant dual credit, which you've heard us mention before, that continues to grow. It's up about 628 students. That's identified under the classification of high school students on your right side of the report. Part-time enrollment, Ann had mentioned this, and it's down. It shows up on here, but because most of your dual credit students fall within part-time enrollment, that clouds that a little bit. But part-time, if you said boil it down, what are the two main issues driving it? Part-time and international for the most part, as far as challenges that we need to keep an eye on. Full-time enrollment's down somewhat, 2.5%. Undergraduate enrollment is just kind of, you're going to see an up, down on all these. That shows the volatile nature of the enrollment right now. Undergrad enrollment is up 1.2% and graduate down 6.5%. I would equate some of the graduate and part-time again to the comments Ann suggested to you earlier about the economy improving and folks going back to work, and that absolutely impacts what we do in EEM here, but in schools across the country. Transfer enrollment, if you flip this document over to the top right, continues to still be a positive shining star with our transfer center. Chris and his team do a very nice job of working with KCTCS as well as the other four-year schools in the state and beyond the state. KCTCS enrollments are up slightly, 5.1%. That's the highest spring enrollment there we've had in several years. Out-of-state enrollments are up 6.1%. That's a byproduct of Jace and the missions team doing a lot of out-of-state, out-of-region recruitment, looking for those new markets, knowing that sometimes the Kentucky pipeline is not as strong numerically as far as students in the pipeline that it could be. Enrollment from other Kentucky schools. I think this is speaking a little bit to affordability. Mainly those are private schools, and they're coming to us as well, and we're seeing picked up somewhat interest at least in that as well. And we've had the standard top five institutions, and I don't know how much of that you've seen all these before, the majors, counties, and all these different things. And you say, well, what's going on in some of these counties? At best guess, as we talk with students and students who did not enroll or did not return, a lot of this is economic driven, and they're working and doing other things. but again, the part-time and international seem to be things we need to keep top of mind and a little energy on. One thing, just not only want to talk the enrollment currently this spring, which I know we've already done it quite a bit this morning, but also we need to give kind of a heads up as where we're looking going to the future in the fall 17. You say, well, that's several months away. Well, it's here. Orientation begins for fall 17 a week from today. And admitted students, Jason team report to me, are up a little over 1,200 students from where we were a year ago this week. We were at fall 16, we were at 7,316 students, and now for students beginning with us this fall, this August, we're a little over 8,500, 8,575. And I mentioned that as well as topper orientation RSVPs because we haven't registered anyone for the fall, the new students. So we have to look to indicators, the tea leaves, if you will, to give us where the fall might be. And admits are one way to do that. Topper orientation registrations are another. And then housing deposits, which again, that's too early to speak to those. Brian might be able to tell us that in the coming weeks and months as well. But those kind of give us a flare of, hey, what's going to happen this fall? And again, it's entirely too early to jump off into that. Do we have questions or concerns there with the report itself? And then I want to... Yes, ma'am.
Just one thing. On the international enrollments on the second page, right-hand column, what would, and I know you might have all top head, but what would you estimate is the relative percentage-wise of undergraduate versus graduates in that category?
I would think the vast majority of that would be undergraduate. Stephanie, would you agree with that? Or is it?
Yes. Over the past few years, I had a 21.
Sorry.
Mm-hmm.
Hello, everybody. From the past few years, we did a 10-year analysis of our international student population, and many of you may have already known this, that most of our international students were enrolled in graduate programs, and by about 80%, 25% undergraduate. Within the past 5 years, that shifted to about 75% as undergraduate to about 25% as graduate. There are many different factors, and I know that these numbers on this report are not glowing for international, that they're down. I'm actually quite excited to say I think we're at our all-time low, and we can move up from there. There are a number of different contributing factors that had happened for our international enrollments to perform this past year. The good thing is for our Saudi students, they're graduating. We had a huge boom that came in. We decided, hey, we're here, we graduated, they left. So that's why you see that population to go a little bit higher. The good thing with the Saudi Arabian population, though, our enrollments continue to be stable for middle-income students. Despite what you hear about the scholarship program, we're sustaining those numbers, which is fortunate. The other contributing factor, large contributing factor, has been our short-term sustainability of students. We had programs that were coming in that were only here for a semester, large cohorts of 100 to 150. They didn't stay to graduate, they left, and those programs were not sustainable. And that took hits to the enrollments. The other item was pathway programs. We all know the separation with Navitas. We fortunately have taken that over to help generate additional revenue for this institution. We have continued to grow within our undergraduate pathway numbers. At this time, we don't have a graduate pathway. And that has taken a huge hit on the graduate numbers as well. So for graduate, for pathway numbers, we can account for everything that has happened, why we have a deficit, and we're looking at the double that capacity in the next couple of years.
Stephanie Seagren directs our Office of International Enrollment Management. For those of you who may not, that's Stephanie. And she is on the international marketplace. She's a student, aware, and market sensitive.
Try me. Hey.
Brian?
Yep.
There's been some data that we experience first-time students in the fall. Difference between the applications that are accepted and the number of students who actually attend ranges in a percentage on the low side, most recently about one-third to about 42%. 42% has probably been more consistent over the past years except for fall of 16. Can you address that? I mean, why there's a difference, significant difference? I guess kids will come in and say, we'll make applications four or five different places and then make, and is there a way we can attack that?
You've hit on it. Many of them are applying to more schools where it used to be 3 to 5. Now they're applying to 7, 8, and 10 institutions, and then it speaks to the yield. The yielding activity, you know, as to why they've applied, they've been admitted, but they're shopping the best package, best fit, the affordability, and we've increased in the last year or so all things related to yield. So from the point of admission to the point of enrollment, getting him here in the fall, there's a litany of services trying to, you know, turn that conversation to make sure that they're here with us. Jason and his team each year have added new yielding activities, from going out into the regions and having send-off parties, to mailing red towels to families, to calling and texting campaigns. And by the way, I didn't mention that, but texting campaigns have been very successful in the last 6-8 months with us, not only on the new student, recruiting them in, but for Chris's team on the retention side, encouraging them to enroll, satisfy their fees, those sorts of things. Again, speaking to them where they are. The emails, the snail mails, all that. Social media works to a certain extent, but it seems texting is, we've had great success. But to answer your question, it really becomes an aggressive yield at this point to turn those apps into students who show up in the fall.
Do we try to identify some of their problems, like I don't have enough money to go to school or things of that nature? I mean, it seems like you've got a program in place you're trying to.
Quite a bit of it. I would say it was a mixture between affordability and fit. And, you know, scholarship packages with other institutions. Jace, would you have any other thoughts that may come up in your dialogue?
Yes, we surveyed in November. We surveyed two populations of admitted students. We surveyed the population of all admitted students to WKU for fall of 16 that actually were here and enrolled, and then we surveyed those that didn't come. And, I mean, exponentially, the number one reason was affordability. We got a lot of... I still hope to come in 2 years. Mm. I hope to come next year. I'm going to work for a semester or for a year. There were other responses. It's too close to home. It's too far from home. I mean, we can't move campus. I don't think you as a board want to do that. We've got a pretty good location here. But the number one response for the reason that students don't come here, according to the survey response, and we had a pretty good response rate on that of students who did not enroll. About 10% of those students didn't enroll anywhere, mm-hmm. and about 90% of them had enrolled in another institution, most of them at a KCTCS institution, which again speaks to affordability. So we're monitoring that and tracking that, and I think that's why our transfer recruitment efforts are more and more important, to make sure that, okay, if that's the path you're going to take, is starting at a two-year institution, we don't want you to get done with that associate's degree and decide, I'm not going to go to WKU after all. I'm going to get a job or go somewhere else. So.
Yeah, your transfer seemed to be a lot closer to a larger percentage. Of course, I guess that's if I was going to transfer, I've already made my mind up.
Mm-hmm. And regarding yield a little bit, Dr. Meredith shared the number of students who apply to multiple institutions. I think historically at WKU and at other institutions, a decade ago could have been pretty confident that if a student came to orientation and we gave that student a schedule, they were probably going to come here in the fall. About one-third of students now attend a minimum of 3 orientations. So we know that if they're coming to a third of them, if they're coming to orientation this summer, this spring at WKU, the next day they might be going to UK's, or they may have gone to EKU's last week. I think that's where some of the changes that are happening in advising are really going to help. You know, it's unfortunate to pour the resources into recruiting a student that WKU does, only to have them have maybe a less than optimal experience when they get to orientation and actually sit down with that advisor. I think a lot of what Chris and Dr. Meredith and Dr. Lee have been working on in terms of advising is going to help with that. And so, you know, we're optimistic that, that some of these, they're big changes and they're going to require, you know, it's going to require buy-in, but I think they're going to move us in the right direction.
I think that,
and put us more in line with best practices and national trends.
I think the two things, too, that Jason, we mentioned affordability and that Jason mentioned the 10% that do not go anywhere are those that choose to go to a two-year community college. When we say affordability, I don't mean to imply that WKU is not affordable by any means. We're very competitive on that. It's just the families tell us, even though the economy has improved, it hasn't necessarily trickled down to the family to finance the college education. I mean, we've, you know, shoulder to shoulder, our tuition, our room, board, meal plans, we can hold our own. It's just a matter of they're struggling financially. So.
And play off that question a minute. Maybe you can address this as well. In your data, in that tier that you survey, do you all drill down next? Because just to say it's not, I can't come because I can't afford it is a pretty broad term. You know, do you find out that it's $1,000 or? That could be a very small piece.
Right. We have not gotten down to that level of specificity because we're asking them a lot of questions about, you know, the recruitment process, not just why did you ultimately not come, but, you know, we're asking them, did you receive the same number of publications from WKU that you did from other institutions who were discussing college?
I think it'd be interesting to find out what that gap is.
It's a good piece to add and consider that if affordability is the issue, can you estimate the shortfall?
If someone's going to another institution because of a full ride, that's another whole set of circumstances. But that small gap is what I'm more concerned about, especially when it's talking about first-time students coming. I mean, when Dr. Ransel says how many people is this the first generation, it's huge. It has been since I've been on the board. And there's got to be a relationship between that and in a Kentucky where the unemployment rate is higher, all those economic factors. And if we could just figure out if it was small, then we could go to our donor base and say, we don't need full rides, we need... We need $500, and it'll make a difference of a student coming and succeeding. That to me is a big opportunity.
The biggest challenge, not the biggest, a challenge we have, and you touched on it. An awful lot of our student population, the population from which we draw most of our students, if you take a 25 county radius, coming from small towns, small communities. And you see it at graduation from families where we're the first in their immediate family to pursue a college degree. Given that reality for us, an awful lot of students don't have the support mechanisms at home to put them in the queue for financial aid on time, to meet with our financial aid officers, understand what's available to them. And time goes by and springtime arrives and golly, it's $4,000, $5,000 to go there. And where am I going to live? I can't afford $2,000 for a room. I can't afford $1,200 for a meal plan. Damn, I've only got $25 in my pocket. And, you know, I'm exaggerating, but not much. And it's a matter of communication and guidance counselors. We work with counselors. You know, we continue to do everything we can, but we still are dealing with a population in large measure that isn't familiar with these dynamics, the nomenclature, the timeline, the process. And it's now that's not universal because we get a lot of students who are familiar and know exactly what they're doing. They come from Barron County and Hardin County and Davis County and Warren County and Jefferson County. But a lot of those counties in between, it's a challenge making sure they understand what's available to them if they only looked in a timely manner or were informed enough to know what questions to ask and when to ask them. And we rely on the guidance counselors a lot to help us do that. But, you know, they got a big job with 300, 400, 500 seniors in the senior class. So anyway, I'm not sharing anything you don't already know, but it's communication. It's a challenge. One thing I want to say about this chart, you talk about high school bill credit. This includes 2,300 high school bill credit enrollments, give or take. And I mean, mentioned the international, and we're on that. We're exploring new international markets. We're going to replace markets that may be in decline. We'll replace them with other countries and other continents and refill that pipeline. But I go to the very last line, non-traditional, age 25 and up. You've heard that repeated many times. For the last 4 or 5 years, this has been our biggest challenge. And I don't know the exact number, but I bet in the last 5 years, I bet we've lost close to 2,000 students in this category. Would be my guess. I don't know. I bet it's not far off. And that's, we got to replace part-time adult learners with other populations. Domestic, out of state, international, more aggressive online enrollments with an additional online model to penetrate massive online enrollments as other institutions, some are beginning to do. It's not business as usual for us, and we've got to understand new markets, new opportunities, and aggressively pursue them if we're going to resume a growth pattern in our enrollment pattern.
I have one.
Let me send this around up to Buncey, gets there, to others in the room as well. I found this article out of Fortune magazine recently, and it tells a story. I mean, you want to frame our dilemma in a two-paragraph soundbite? Send this around. Both the top two paragraphs and the paragraphs at the bottom of the page.
I have a question and then a comment, and I don't think everything's in the number of students that constitute your yield, but do we calculate yield on people who fully apply, or do we use inquiries? In other words, if somebody just inquires and asks for application materials, is that number counted?
Admitted students.
Fully admitted. Okay, that's helpful. The second thing is, and I think the data is useful, and I'm aware that folks in enrollment management are going to bed at night and waking up in the morning worrying about this and looking for ways to affect the numbers. But I would also point out that just as Gary commented earlier, we're not the only ones with this issue.
Yes.
And nationally, all but two states are experiencing some serious kinds of reductions. And so that the message there is that when you look at these numbers and you ask yourself, what if we put a lot, I mean, we are putting effort, but even more effort on retention of what we've got. I mean, those of you that are in business every day, what's the thing? It's easier for every customer you lose. You lose 10 more, whatever. I don't know what the number is. But the fact is, and Ann, you can stop me on this, 100 students retained is $1 million. Turn it to money. And our immediate answer, I mean, we're trying to beat the bushes for the same student everybody else is. So there are two answers. Either change the nature of the population we're searching for and the product we deliver, or affect the retention. And it seems to me that we know how to do that. When you look at the retention numbers on what we do for a number of programs, a number of students, our academy, our honor students, and I want to compliment our athletic director, because I think athletics has always had it right in how you retain students. Now, you've got some good motivators that the rest of us don't have, okay? But that doesn't matter. Motivators or not, they know how to retain their students. And so I think part of the answer is looking at what do we do that works, and how do you do that for the other 90% of our students? And some of it has to do with those first experiences.
And I might throw a few things we've kind of got in the works in various stages of development that kind of speak exactly to Barbara's point, because I think for a variety of reasons, partly the financial one, but partly our own pride as educators, that if we bring somebody here, we want to see that student be successful and graduate. And we want to see 100% of them be successful and graduate. And that's not quite where we are. But we've got a few things in various stages of development now that kind of speak to that. Jace alluded to some conversations we're having about advising. The good news about advising is that there are about 600 faculty and staff on this campus who advise. The bad news is that about 600 faculty and staff on this campus advise. And how do you make sure that everybody's getting the same message, that there's continuity as a student talks to this advisor and goes to the next advisor? How do you make sure that some of those advisors who've been here a long time like me are advising the way we used to do it in 1979, but there are a whole lot better ways to do it now, and couldn't we make sure that that gets communicated? So we're looking at some ways to kind of put a central nervous system in the advising system that lets us communicate more effectively and draws that group together more as a kind of a network. Just to give you one other number with this, we have 15,000 change of degree programs every year. You know, 15,000 of those things. I mean, maybe that's a good thing, but maybe that's not a good thing. And is there some way that advising should be intervening in that? And as a student leaves a major in health and human services and goes to a major in Ogden College, there's essentially an advisor here and there's an advisor here. But how do we make sure that gets bridged so that the student really knows what they're getting into as they make that kind of transition? And Chris and his folks are taking some really hard looks at this. So a lot of conversations around making advising more effective. We're pioneering a summer bridge program through DLO this summer with the idea that a student would come in, would take 6 hours, would also have some kind of introduction to college life and living in the residence hall and that sort of thing. But I think that's got a whole lot of possibilities. One of the things that has to happen is that we need to move away from what we call developmental classes, where a student doesn't get degree completion credit for taking English 055. We're moving in the direction of co-requisite courses where the student takes English 100, but it's maybe not the standard English 100. Maybe there's an additional contact hour with it. Maybe there's something else collaborative with it. But there's a whole lot of data nationwide that indicates that if we get students into these co-requisite classes, the likelihood that they're going to graduate is substantially greater. And one other number just kind of throw out here, because I know folks kind of drum their fingers some about developmental classes and do they work. Approximately 30% of our graduates have had at least one developmental studies class that they either took here or they took someplace else. So it is an important part of the undergraduate experience, and done right, it can be successful with the kinds of things that we're trying to do. But we're doing some more things with learning communities, especially in Ogden College. And we went out and bought a piece of software that helps students and faculty and advisors do their semester schedule. And kind of the idea is that instead of sitting down with what you all remember as that tabloid and going through there looking for classes, you plug in when you work, when you're not going to be available for classes, and it generates a schedule. And you and your advisor spend your time talking about things that you ought to be talking about and not thumbing through the tabloid looking for your classes. So we got some things we're working with here, but Barb is exactly right. If we get folks here, we got to be more successful than we have been. We got some things in the works with that.
Provost Lee, I'd just like to say that admissions has made a contact to the National Alumni Association Board to start helping with recruitment and some other areas. So they're looking at alumni to be able to go and recruit new students, good students. Not that all students aren't good, but the types of students we'd like to see here at Western, and this is a new thing that they've started. Mark, you want to elaborate on that, or have I said about what?
No, I think you've added that the Alumni Association is going to be participating, too, with those send-off parties that Jace mentioned earlier. And in just the last 30 days since we put the call out to the alumni base, we've already recorded about 4 referrals. So it's just early days, but it'll be a help.
And also, too, we have such a big alumni chapter in Louisville that we've been attending admission events and actually scheduling some to recruit students. And I think that getting alumni that love WKU, sometimes I blindly tell everybody, you just need to come here. I mean, I don't know what they're majoring in, but I just think it's such a good school. But sometimes that enthusiasm you know, just does it. And I get all excited, if you can imagine that. I even knocked over a whole row of bats one day. I was so excited bouncing around. But we have all these events when we do the scholarships. And what's neat about our scholarship program that we have at Louisville is that we have several siblings that have applied for a WKU scholarship, have gotten it from our Greater Louisville Alumni Chapter. 3 years later, we have a sibling, another sibling come through and also get awarded one. And, you know, that is such a good recruitment tool as well, is you have families that really believe in the university. So I think their idea of using our working admissions with the National Alumni Association is a very good program for recruitment. I just wanted to kind of put a plug for that as well.
Well, and you make a crucial point, because the success of this institution and all of its endeavors is tied to the community spirit that binds us all together on this campus, the regional campuses, and out in the in the wider world. So I appreciate that very much.
And also, too, I noticed that at the admissions, this goes to your question, Gil. Soon as when they were having the last admissions event I participated in, which would have been last fall, those potential students immediately come in and apply at computers that are sent up. So you have a lot of people, like they were saying, that apply to 7, 8, 10 different colleges, because you're encouraged once you sit down to go ahead and make your application to WKU. And then I think they then turn around and go look for funding. So the application's done that at that event. But like Jace was mentioning, they may go to UK or they may have gone to EKU the day before. But they are applying for every – so as soon as they walk in the door, that is what they walk right to the computer and apply to come to WKU. Are you seeing that, Jason? I mean, is that pretty accurate?
Well, that's something we've been intentional about, is we've long gone out into communities and held open house type events.
That's right.
And, you know, we get students who, after attending that event, are very excited about WKU, and we want to make sure that that takes them to the next step in the recruitment funnel. So we call it on-site admission, but we've done more of that on some of those events in the community, as opposed to we've done it for a long time on the big campus-wide open houses that we host here on campus, but we've started doing more of that
in
the communities to make it easier for the student. You know, one thing, if I could back up just a minute about the alumni recruitment, that also serves a very practical function for us too. You know, when we look at areas of growth, Kentucky's not one of them. There will be about 800 fewer diplomas awarded this spring than there were last spring in Kentucky. Nationally, there'll be about 83,000 fewer diplomas awarded this spring than were awarded last spring. But that doesn't mean that there aren't areas of growth. It might be down in Miami-Dade County, Florida. If we have an alumni base down there that that can work with those students, that helps us to stretch our budget further, as opposed to, well, we've got to fly someone down to Florida to cover this college fair and make these high school visits. So, you know, a lot of it is practical, as well as getting alumni involved and allowing them to share their firsthand experience. So we have to go to where the students are and where areas of growth are going to be represented. Unfortunately, it's going to be some time before we see that number go back up in Kentucky, just due to the population.
Obviously, this is a topic we could have a lot of discussion on.
Sure.
Everybody has great ideas. I applaud everyone for jumping into the discussion. Clearly, the university cannot stand with the status quo in this arena, and I'm glad to know that we're working hard in a lot of different areas. I think some of the board has maybe read the book, The University Next Door, which speaks to a lot of things and a lot of techniques and strategies. University of South New Hampshire, I think, is really taking over a lot of area with the distance learning, and we're poised to compete in that arena, I think. And so hopefully we can carry this discussion forward. Another time, it may be a good time to segue into our last informational item, and some new techniques in the classroom,
and maybe
no.
let me end this discussion on a positive note on this chart. Looking for something good to take away, compliment to our admissions staff. Tennessee implemented the Tennessee Promise Program the year before last, and universities across Tennessee took it with Tennessee Promise offering, this, I believe I'm correct in this, Brian, free tuition to go to a community college in Tennessee. Is that Tennessee Promise Program?
Nutshell.
And universities across Tennessee took a big hit. One of the universities in Kentucky took a pretty significant hit, and we're up. So that's a really encouraging sign, because we depend heavily on those 15, 16 counties to the south of us in that half moon below the border of the Nashville area and surrounding counties. So that, if you're looking for a good news to take away from this enrollment report, we are really doing well when other institutions are other four-year campuses are struggling in Tennessee because of the Tennessee Promise Program.
Just one final comment to feed into Dr. Today, who's, I think, going to talk about the flipped classroom, but he and his committee, the High Impact Practices Committee, is extremely involved in these conversations of retention. And there'll be reports coming out, I think, later in the semester on that, where we've surveyed students' needs, where they are, good, bad, and ugly, even students that were here who did not return, those sorts of things. And that committee is really doing some good work. And Jay Todd could even speak to the college advisor, college schedule software the provost mentioned. I don't believe software solves problems, but it certainly can help in allowing free up time so that our advisors can do the holistic advising with these students. It's a software that works much like when you go to order on Amazon. It's very handy, very user-friendly. You can use it on your mobile and roll on, and the students love it that we, Jay Todd, if they didn't, tell me, but I think they did.
It's fantastic. They're going to love it. Yep.
Anyway.
Dr. Today can elaborate on
how technology
is changing how we disperse information.
And let me give a quick introduction to Jerry here. Dr. Bale has challenged me since I became provost. Couldn't it be possible that you could make it possible for the board to see a little bit better into the academic enterprise? So Jerry is a very dynamic presenter. He is the director of our Center for Faculty Development, and I asked him back in the fall semester to chair a committee that's working very extensively with folks in student life on high-impact practices, things that we can do in the classroom and other areas on campus that increase the likelihood that a student is going to persevere and graduate. One of those high-impact practices is getting students involved in the classroom and the learning environment in a little different way. And Philip has asked me a bit about flipped classrooms, and so I asked Jerry to come and visit with you all a little bit today about flipped classrooms. Jerry?
Dr. Bale, Provost Lee, thanks for the opportunity. Thanks to all of you for giving me a few minutes to talk a little bit about this concept of flipped classrooms. They're not new. They've been around for a while, but as I'll spend some time talking about, changes in instructional technology, bandwidth, access to the internet, tablets, smartphones, it's made the possibility of doing flipped classrooms much easier and allows us to scale them up. I'm going to be talking about flipped classrooms and traditional classrooms as ideal types. There's a faculty teach in the middle. So we very rarely see a purely flipped classroom, and we very rarely see a pure traditional classroom. A lot of the reality is in the middle. A lot of our faculty are experimenting with these technologies, using these technologies in the classroom. But just to, but before we get into the gray area, let's talk about a flipped classroom, as EDUCAUSE defines it, is a pedagogical model in which the lecture and homework elements of a course are reversed. EDUCAUSE is a nonprofit IT organization, and this is one of the best definitions I've seen to reflect what a flipped classroom represents. So when we think about what a typical classroom activity would be versus what homework would be in a traditional classroom. In a traditional classroom, classroom activities are typically allocated to things like lecturing. A faculty member may lecture for 20 or 30 minutes, maybe then do some discussion with the students. Maybe there'd be an opportunity to do a micro-activity, something like a think, pair, share, or engaging the students into some small group work. And so this would be a small opportunity for some applied learning, and then maybe continue on with the lecture toward the end of the course. And then for homework, where in the classroom it's content dissemination, in a traditional classroom, homework would be allocated for more higher levels of cognitive application and cognitive thinking, things like application, analysis, and synthesis. So for homework, this is where we would see students engaged in individual or collaborative projects. If you walk through DSU on an evening at 7 or 8 o'clock, you see students clustered together working on group projects for their classes. Maybe doing analysis of case studies, the development of presentations that they'll give in their classroom in the next class session. Maybe working on lab exercises, solving of problems or equations in a math or statistics course, and obviously completing required reading and working on various writing assignments. This is the traditional classroom that many of us think about in a higher education setting. In the classroom, it's lecture, some discussion, some microactivity, but all of the application happens for homework. What a flipped classroom does is it flips those. So the homework becomes the content dissemination, and the classroom activities are allocated towards the application, synthesis, and analysis. So for homework, we can have students watch a lecture. They can watch it online. For homework, we can have them engage in discussion. They can use the discussion board on Blackboard. For homework, we can still have them do some small microactivities. They can work on these small online assignments. There's still the completion of required reading. And obviously for homework, they're still going to have to complete maybe some of the longer writing assignments, your 5-10-page papers. But in the classroom, this is where the application analysis and synthesis happens. And it happens under the mentorship and guidance of the faculty member. So instead of in the traditional classroom where students are off doing this hard, high-level stuff on the cognitive Bloom's taxonomy on their own, now they do it in the classroom under the mentorship and guidance of a faculty member. So in the classroom, you can do individual and collaborative projects. You can have students work on case studies. They can develop presentations, do lab exercises, problem solve and work on equations, and actually work on some smaller, shorter writing assignments. Our math department here at WKU has some fantastic faculty who completely flipped their classrooms, where the students watch the lectures at home, and then they come in and they work on problems, and the faculty member floats from table to table and with graduate students helping students work on the problems. So, you know, where I worked on math problems in college, on my own at home, struggling in my parents' house, I was a commuter student. Now students can work on math problems and have a faculty member right there to help them address any problems that they might have. With a flipped classroom, students are exposed to new information prior to coming to class. Students can also complete these online assessments of their learning prior to coming to class. So students can actually check in, am I getting the material? Am I understanding the material? So that the student can be confident that when I go to class the next day, I know this information and I'm prepared to engage in some kind of activity with my professor. And then the students can then use class time to complete those higher level cognitive activities, some of them I'll talk about in a second, under the mentorship and guidance of a faculty member. So what's allowed this to happen? We've seen some improvements in instructional technology as well as the increase of bandwidth and the widespread use of electronic devices that has allowed the flipped classroom model to become more pervasive in higher education. Faculty today have the ability to actually record a lecture on their desktop computer, on their laptop, and assign it for homework. And they can build these online assessments, build them into Blackboard, use tools that build into Blackboard, which is our learning management system, and students can complete some of these activities for homework and therefore come to class prepared. Our university provides a program called MediaSite. This is a lecture capture software that faculty and students can use. It resides on the desktop and basically allows you to screen capture what's on your screen. It captures your image, and it also captures your audio. You can make the recording on your computer. It uploads to a server behind the scenes, and then you can generate a link that you can send to students or embed it within our learning management system that allows students to watch these videos at home and after they're assigned for homework. As of last week, we have about 15,000 videos that have been recorded through MediaSite that are stored on a server. Now, these videos could be varied in length, varied in purpose. I'm not saying all 15,000 videos are used specifically for flipped classroom, but we have faculty who are using MediaSite to record the content and make that content available to students. This is what a student would see in media sites. There's a PowerPoint presentation that I'm giving on the micro-interactionist tradition and sociological theory. This is just a screenshot of the presentation. We have the ability to transcribe the presentation so that it's ADA compliant. So for people with disabilities, they can actually read the text. And anyone, you don't have to have a disability. Everyone has access to that transcript as an additional learning tool. So by assigning these online lectures for homework, faculty have the ability now to engage students in more of applied learning and critical reflection. So if you're familiar with Bloom's taxonomy, the content dissemination at the lower level of the taxonomy is focused on understanding, right, the low-level cognitive stuff. But we want to push students towards the higher-level cognitive abilities, the application, the synthesis, the evaluation of information, because that's what our employers are looking for from our graduates. They actually want our graduates to be able to find information, evaluate what information is good, what information is bad, synthesize it, and present it back to them in a useful way that can be used in the nonprofit, in the corporation, in the business. So when you use a flipped classroom, you can actually have students use and apply the new knowledge that they learned the night before. They might engage in data collection and manipulation. So you might do a lecture on statistics. They watch it for home. They do it for homework. And then when they come into class, they're actually playing in a lab and analyzing data. You could do experimentation and problem solving, help students organize new ideas, assess and evaluate new theories, as well as compare and contrast new information. Now, one of the things I want to make sure I do articulate clearly is that flipped classrooms really do require thoughtful preparation and really good instructional design support. It would be unrealistic to think that a faculty member could take a traditional class that they've developed and flip it overnight. That doesn't happen. And very few faculty might dedicate an entire summer to flipping a traditional class, to taking a traditional class and turning it into a flipped class. What we're more likely to see is incremental changes. So a faculty member flips a lesson or two one semester, and then the next semester flips two more lessons, and the following semester flips another two. So maybe over 2 or 3 years, they build up to a flipped class entirely. Some faculty members may not want to flip their class at all, but maybe they're still using these instructional technologies like lecture capture to give them the opportunity to do more applied learning, active learning in the classroom. Instead of just lecturing at students for 55 minutes or 80 minutes, let's put some of my lecture online, assign it for homework to free up at least some of the class time to engage in active learning and applied learning with students, to use the class time for those higher levels in the taxonomy. So we see our faculty using these online lecture recordings. We see them using these online formative assessments in Blackboard to support a variety of learning modalities. So there are some faculty who have completely flipped their classrooms. But we have a lot of faculty who have what we call web-enhanced courses. So they teach a traditional face-to-face course, but they've migrated some of that content into our learning management system. So students are doing online quizzes. Students are watching some online recordings, and maybe they have an online textbook, and all of that stuff happens out on the internet, and that frees up that class time to do more active applied learning. Obviously, our online classes require this lecture capture software, and then we have lots of courses at our university that have this blended hybrid quality to them. Some of the content is online, some of the content is delivered in a face-to-face environment. So let me give you an example of what we've seen as the product of a flipped classroom here at WKU. So one of my side jobs over the last few years is to direct something that we call the Online Learning Research Office. It was part of DLO. And what we did is did an evaluation with Dr. Carrie McDaniel in the biology department about a new lab that she flipped. So she was tasked with taking Biology 131, the Human Anatomy and Physiology Lab, as well as Biology 231, the Advanced Human Anatomy and Physiology Lab, and basically flipping the class. They adopted a common e-textbook for all students. The motivation was to reduce costs. They worked out a great deal with McGraw-Hill. If we buy this textbook as a volume purchase and required of all of our students, will you give them a discount on the textbook? And what Carrie decided to do is, in addition to getting that e-textbook, we're going to flip the course. So students will have an e-textbook that they'll read at home. We'll record stuff with MediaSite and have the students watch it at home. And then what that's going to do is standardize the content in all of the labs in these two courses. And it would allow for the lab time to be used entirely for practical application. No lecturing at all happening in the lab. Everything is going to be focused on doing something practical, actually working on lab exercises. So what we did is we surveyed the students who participated in this. We collected some data from them, but we also pulled some data from the Office of Institutional Research to see what this effect had. The black line represents pre-revision versus post-revision. So the line to the left is student grades before we implemented this new flipped classroom, before the biology department did it. And on the right side of the black line is post-revision. And the different lines that you see there, the colors, represent the student's final letter grade in the lab. And the line I'd like you to draw your attention to is the gray one, the D's, F's. What we saw after we flipped the classroom is that the percentage of students who were in D's and F's in the biology lab went down. We didn't see a whole lot of change in the A's, and basically what that suggests is A students are going to get A's, no matter if you do a flipped environment or a traditional environment, they're going to figure it out. But we also saw an uptick in what happened is the D and F students became B and C students in this flipped environment. And when Carrie and I saw this, we went and looked at the literature, and this is a common finding in the flipped classroom environment, in the flipped classroom literature, that when you flip a class, what this did, and when we looked at our student survey data, what we found is that for lower income students, students who were non-traditional, students who were racial ethnic minority, students who were at risk, what the flipped environment forced them to do was to do homework, because they couldn't come to class unprepared. And so those formative assessments online where they could check in on their performance, it forced them to prepare so that when they came to lab, they hated doing it, they didn't like doing it, but it forced them to do it, and we see the evidence in the grade distributions as well. And so, you know, Carrie was a huge part of this. I feel awful presenting this without her here. This is really her brainchild. But we see in our own data that flipped classrooms can have a positive impact in helping students with their grades.
Think that student learning improved and graduation rates are good.
The one thing I should have mentioned with Bio 131, 231, those are gatekeeper courses. You want to do anything in STEM, especially in health, you got to get through those two courses. And so we were really excited to see that trend.
The other thing exciting about this concept to me is that in a world of increasing competition of proprietary tools for profits out there that for bricks and mortar universities to survive going forward and to thrive, it's going to be because of relationships. And the student-faculty relationships are at the heart
absolutely
of the university experience. Mr. Wilson hopes that.
Absolutely.
That class time is going to be more personal interaction. Play a big role in which bricks and mortar universities are still around 10 years from now.
You look at the high-impact practices Provost Lee talked about, what they all have in common is they build community between faculty and staff and faculty and staff and students.
It really addresses all the problems that we spent a couple of hours talking about. Comments?
Thanks for the opportunity.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you all very much.
Dr. Bell, I would have been a much better student if we'd had this type of program. Especially after a Thursday night when I had been out. So I could have prepared before I went out. Then that's right.
Exactly.
Volunteering in the soup kitchen and come back on Friday. I would have been a much better student because this would have given me an opportunity to learn the way I need to learn.
We've still got some degrees we could talk to you
okay,
about.
Okay, well, good.
So.
May I do that? I know. Exactly.
Thank you. We're going to break. Let the regents eat lunch. I think it's ready for us. And as soon as we get that task out of the way, we'll get back on to the Student Affairs Committee.
It's your lunch. Bring it on back in here.